Okay, it's my pleasure now to introduce Robert Sluka. Robert grew up in the Detroit area, studied marine biology and fisheries at Michigan State and the University of Miami in Florida in the U.S., and spent the last 10 years working in the Maldives and in India, and he moved last year to the U.K. He will be speaking to us today on tsunami relief and coastal fishing communities, the science and appropriate technologies supporting the sustainable use of tropical marine resources. Let's give Robert a warm welcome.
On December 26, 2004, an earthquake of magnitude 9.3 struck off the northern coast of Sumatra. The resultant waves spread across the Indian Ocean, eventually killing an estimated 250,000 people. The tsunami was a major disaster for millions across the Indian Ocean region. However, as damaging as the tsunami was to this area, this event occurred in the context of threats to coastal habitats, which were already significantly impacting the lives of these coastal fishing communities. Tropical marine ecosystems are some of the most productive on the planet. Additionally, these ecosystems support an amazingly high biodiversity. Two of the most important tropical marine habitats are coral reefs and mangroves. Coral reefs are built by coral polyps. These colonial animals build calcareous structures, which provide refuge and food for thousands of different organisms. The term mangrove refers both to specific trees, which can tolerate high salinity, and also the entire plant community associated with these trees. In addition to overcoming high salinity, they also deal effectively with anoxia and tidal inundation. They provide nursery grounds for fishery species, which tend to migrate further offshore as they approach adulthood. In addition, these mangrove ecosystems provide shoreline protection, wood for fuel and construction, and also are a source of medicinal plants. The coral reefs and mangrove forests are among the richest habitats in the world. Those who depend upon these resources are among the poorest of the poor. Coral reefs and mangrove provide livelihood and nutrition to fishing communities across the Indian Ocean. And in this map, you'll see the distribution of reefs and mangroves throughout the Indian Ocean. And the reefs here are located in red, and the mangrove areas in kind of a especially green, it's a yellowish bit there. And you can see the entire Red Sea coast, Eastern Africa, Persian Gulf, Maldives there in the middle of the Indian Ocean, all throughout Southeast Asia. These coastlines are dominated by coral reefs and mangroves. Estimates vary, but certainly millions of people depend upon coral reefs and mangroves for their direct supply of food, while millions use them part-time or in dire need. Many of the countries in this region are very poor, and the deterioration of these resources directly impacts these communities who often have no other alternatives. In the absence of these other livelihood alternatives or other safety nets, reef and mangrove health are essential for sustaining these fishing communities. This map shows the red star there is the epicenter of the earthquake that generated the tsunami wave. And next, this is a visualization that shows the spread of the wave across the Indian Ocean. And the red there indicates wave height, and the blue a trough. And it's a very small range there because, as you know, in deep water, the tsunami actually is not very high. And only the wave gets very big when it approaches land. So that's the spread. In Aceh, Indonesia, the tsunami killed an estimated 15 to 20% of fishers, and damaged or destroyed over 10,000 fishing boats. Damage to coral reefs by the tsunami usually consisted of overturned coral heads, destruction of branching corals, and smothering by sediment. In some areas, the backwash of the wave caused more damage to the reef than the wave itself, as debris was washed from inshore onto the reefs. In some areas near the earthquake epicenter, entire reef systems were uplifted and died. Overall, though, the damage to coral reefs was much less than was expected. In Thailand, one study of 174 different sites showed that only 13% of the sites were heavily damaged, whereas over 60% of the sites had very little damage or no damage at all. In Aceh, in Indonesia, damage was also quite localized and overall very limited. In places much farther from the earthquake epicenter, such as Maldives, Seychelles, and Yemen, the wave had lost most of its energy and its destructive power, and coral damage was minimal. Much of the immediate reef restoration employed after the tsunami was very simple in nature, overturning coral heads so there are still live corals so the coral could grow, and cleaning debris from the reefs. Longer-term remediation could involve adding additional substrate for colonization or developing coral nurseries and transplanting coral. In this case, this is something called a reef ball that's a commercial product that's been developed. And you see it has holes there so that the fish can go inside and protection from predation. And over time, corals will settle. You can see in this last part here that corals will grow quite nicely as they're provided substrate for growth. In this case, a number of divers were gone out right after the tsunami and picked up pieces of live coral that would die, through being washed around in the waves. What they would take is a marine cement and cement them into plastic cups and put them in these fence-like structures and place them on the reef. And as they grow, they can be transplanted onto areas of coral reefs to stimulate coral growth. However, both of these methods, the artificial structures in this transplantation, are very expensive and have not been used over wide areas like the tsunami or the tsunami damage. So in most cases, as I mentioned, there was little coral damage, and it was decided that it was sufficient to let the system repair itself naturally. This shows damage to mangrove ecosystems, pre-tsunami and post-tsunami. In the pre-tsunami shot, you see there's a number of aquaculture ponds. This is in Aceh, in Indonesia. And you can see as the wave went through, a lot of this forest cover was destroyed. In one study, they estimated damage between 30 and 100% of previous dams. Many relief and development organizations focused on replanting mangrove forests. These work programs employed villagers and provided a tangible and beneficial form of development aid. Mangrove seedlings were planted by the million throughout the region, and this is also a major part of the continuing strategy to plant mangrove forests throughout this whole region. In general, the damage done to the marine environment was patchy. In some cases, one side of a bay would be completely destroyed, while the other side remained untouched. Early reports that areas with healthy reefs and mangroves experienced less damage than unhealthy reefs and mangrove forests were too simplistic. Damage to the coastline and its marine habitats proved to be related to many different variables, including distance from the earthquake epicenter, presence of inlets and headlands, gradient to the continental slope, and shoreline elevation. So it's a very complex interaction between the geography and geology of the region, and mangrove forests definitely do provide some protection from normal things like cyclones, but the tsunami wave, there was a lot of interest generated in this idea, and it's proved to be not as stable as most people thought. Much of the initial relief and development work focused on meeting the immediate needs and of those who were traumatized. For those whose livelihoods depended upon fishing, this meant replacing fishing boats and nets. However, in most cases, this relief effort appeared to be uncoordinated and lacked an understanding of the pre-tsunami condition of these habitats and fishing communities. This was no doubt hampered by the immediacy of the situation and the general lack of good data from the small-scale artisanal fisheries of this region. But this resulted in some fishes receiving more boats than they had to start with, while others received none. In addition, in some cases, the wrong types of boats were supplied or unsuitable for the type of environment. Boats were supplied without nets, or were of such dubious quality as the fishermen regarded them being unseaworthy and wouldn't use them. In Thailand, for example, the government estimated that 4,800 boats were lost during the tsunami, but over 6,000 were supplied. The main concern with this is that in some estimates, the fish populations in this area are 10% of what they were 30 years previous to this. So studies concluded that simply returning the fishing communities to pre-tsunami capacity would be detrimental in the long term due to the overfished state of the fishing stocks already. Many relief and development agencies focused on capacity building. In India, where I was worked and I was there during the tsunami, we realized that there was no local group of scientists who could go underwater and look at the damage to the tsunami that the tsunami did to these habitats. And so part of our project was training these young scientists to be able to scuba dive, to go underwater and do underwater research. And we focused on essentially trying to give them resources that would bless the local fishing community. The overwhelming general conclusion of scientific studies was that factors which were most affecting these fishing communities prior to the tsunami were of greater impact on the long-term sustainability of fishing than damage done to the marine environment by the earthquake or the tsunami wave. Now, in light of this, and in a purposeful acknowledgement of the previous work on degradation of the environment by Dr. Calvin DeWitt, I would like to briefly give a summary of the seven main degradations to the tropical Indian Ocean marine ecosystems. You can see it's here, and I'll briefly go over each one. The main threat to these ecosystems comes from overfishing. There are many different definitions of overfishing, but a simple one is when fishing occurs at a level such as to reduce the quantity and quality of target organisms and that it endangers future exploitation. Another type of overfishing is called ecosystem overfishing. This happens when target populations are fished in such a way as to alter the entire ecosystem. An example of this would be bottom trawling. You can see a trawl net being raked here over a muddy habitat. The trawl net is essentially a bag pulled through the water, catching everything in its path. There is usually a heavy beam or other solid device that is attached to the mouth of the net that keeps it open. By dragging this across the bottom, sessile organisms such as corals and anything else are destroyed. In this picture, you see in the upper left-hand corner a deepwater coral colony. And this is in a similar area after a trawler has gone through, and it reduces the area to rubble. In addition, there's a lot of bycatch. Smaller fish, or in this case a large coral, that's been caught in the net will just be thrown overboard. Here you see, this isn't a trawler net exactly, this is a gill net, but a manta ray there has been caught. In this picture here you see the target organism is shrimp, or prawns, and there's very few of them in that net, and most of the rest of the catch will just be dumped overboard and die and be lost. Now, this type of fishing can alter the entire structure and functions of the whole ecosystem. There are other types of destructive methodologies, particularly used in the tropics, such as dynamite fishing and the use of poisons, such as cyanide. Much of my research in tropical fish ecology is focused on species which are targeted in the live fish food trade. And these are particularly sought after by cyanide fishermen. This is a humpback wrasse over here on the left, and these are grouper. And they're highly valued in Hong Kong and throughout Asia. The value of one fish can be in the hundreds of pounds wholesale. Reefs close to Hong Kong have been fished out, and they're sending out fishing fleets farther and farther abroad, as far as Maldives and way out in the South Pacific. And they'll catch the fish, and the fishermen will keep them in cages, keep them alive, and their ship comes from Hong Kong, picks them up, puts them in a live well, and their ship back to Hong Kong. This is the fish. They were probably caught somewhere like Maldives, at an open-air market in Hong Kong, and the people will pick up the fish, pick the fish out before they dine, and I guess it's supposed to taste a lot better than fresh. Now, grouper, one of these target species, hide in holes and crevices on the bottom of the reef, and cyanide is squirted into these holes, stunning the fish and allowing easy removal. Then the problem arises in that this cyanide will also kill the coral and the smaller fish. This is also used extensively collecting aquarium fish throughout the region. In addition to overfishing, there's six additional threats that I want to briefly go over. There's an increasing understanding of the interface between shallow water marine habitats and the adjacent coastal zone. Often activities on land can severely impact marine ecosystems. Examples of this include pollution, nutrients washing into the sea, enriching the growth of algae, which can smother coral. You see this nice outflow pipe here that actually is good for a lot of fish. They find it attracts fish biodiversity, but if it's located near reefs, you can see in the upper left-hand corner where these coral reefs can be overgrown with algae. And here you have a sponge and a reef that's been has a heavy amount of sedimentation that will destroy the coral. Mangroves serve many important ecosystem functions. They also provide wood for cooking and building houses. You see a house structure there being built with mangrove wood. And also in the upper left-hand corner there, that's an area that's been cleared for aquaculture. May wonder why a camel is there. I spent a little time in Yemen, and as we were driving around on the coast there of the Red Sea, one of the biggest problems facing the mangroves there was foraging by wild camel and people grazing with camels there. Climate change is predicted to be detrimental to corals in some areas, but also extend their range in others. With increasing temperature, bleaching of corals will occur more likely. In this case, you see a bleached coral. Corals naturally have a different color that's provided by symbiotic algae. And at temperatures just a few degrees above their normal range, they'll expel this algae. In some cases, depending on the species, it can recover, but in other cases, these areas die. Now, there are a number of diseases and predators which attack and kill corals, and these also appear to be increasing with increasing stress on reefs. And anthropogenic factors appear to be influencing the cycle of these animals, such that the evidence incidence of diseases has increased, and predator populations have exploded to plague levels in some cases. The left-hand slide photo there shows black band disease, as you might imagine. Aptly named, in the upper portion there is live coral, and below the black band is dead coral. And this is here called the crown of thorn starfish, and it's a coral predator, and these can occur in plague numbers. And many people believe this has been induced by human activity. This is a place where I used to visit and work here in Maldives. This is the capital island of Mali in Maldives. And they fill in a lot of the coral lagoons. This type of coastal development, as you can imagine, is quite detrimental to the surrounding marine environment. This also comes from Maldives, the village that I used to live in. And traditionally, Maldivians would build with coral blocks. But now the government has banned this, and they've started to build more concrete blocks. But there's still quite a lot of collecting corals too. Last thing, often the sea is thought of the common area, and most of us are familiar with Harvey's paper on the tragedy of the commons. This, combined with a lack of political will and often ignorance of basic marine ecology, can result in marine habitats being far from the public's eye. Additionally, many of the countries which depend upon tropical marine habitats are very poor. Often conservationists have focused on people as a problem to be solved rather than as images of the living gods whom we should love. I would like to shift the focus from the threats to these habitats to some of the solutions. Fisheries management seeks to control the catch of target species by setting restrictions on the amount taken and the effort used in fishing. Typically, this involves setting limits on the numbers and sizes of species that can be caught, or additionally, certain types of fishing gear can be restricted. However, most of these methodologies require accurate data on the catch, fishing effort, and the biology of the different target species. For most tropical small-scale fisheries, this data is simply not available. One method which requires less data and is intuitively understandable is the concept of marine protected areas, or reserves. While the size, location, and configuration of these reserves is under much debate and the subject of much research, evidence clearly points to the fact that when a significant portion of the coastline is protected from all forms of fishing, there's great benefit to both the ecosystem and the fishermen who can fish outside of the reserve. Within the reserve, previously fished species tend to be larger, more abundant, and produce more offspring. So if we look inside of the reserve, these fish get larger and they're more abundant, they produce more eggs, which float out of the reserve, repopulate the other areas, Additionally, the fish don't necessarily recognize the reserve boundaries, and we find that actually fishermen, their catch per unit effort increases dramatically in areas around the reserves as these larger fish move outside of the reserve. Some of the work I did for my graduate studies was at a marine reserve in the Bahamas. And what this fish here is called the Nassau grouper, and it's one of the most important fish species in the Caribbean. However, in a lot of places in the Caribbean now, it's considered commercially extinct because of overfishing. In this reserve in the Bahamas, this is the Exuma Keys Land and Sea Park, what we find is the biomass of this species is much higher per unit area inside of the park than north or south of the park. Additionally, the fecundity, millions of eggs per hectare, is over seven times higher inside of the park than outside of the park. So showing the benefit of the reserve. We also found actually that along the boundaries of the park, the fishermen would fish and catch larger fish and more fish. So the reserve is not only protecting the fish populations inside the reserve, but the fishermen recognize it as beneficial to them. Now, grouper tend to aggregate to spawn. They'll travel sometimes hundreds of kilometers to a spawning aggregation site. Throughout the year, they tend to live fairly solitary, and then once or twice a year, at certain times in certain places, they'll gather in the thousands in order to spawn. Of course, fishermen like to fish these areas. However, you can see that if you were to fish a spawning aggregation site before the fish have had a chance to spawn, not only do you wipe out the chance of that year's reproduction, but you're also effectively fishing in a huge area. And so it's an important part of these marine reserves to find out from the fishermen or from the science where these fish aggregations are and include them inside the reserve boundaries. Now, marine reserves are especially appropriate for developing countries. There's less information required, there's less regulation required, but however, enforcement is a key issue, as you might imagine. One of the ways that's been developed to help with this is using traditional systems of management, involving the local community in the development and the placement of the reserves, using their own scientific knowledge, and going through the local system and giving the local community power over the reserve. And this has helped dramatically with enforcement. Additionally, marine reserves aren't the only answer. This needs to be integrated into a system of integrated coastal management, because as I mentioned before, all the impacts on the land directly flow right into the water. So what lessons did we learn after the 2004 tsunami? There were many, as you might imagine, but I want to focus on one key finding, and this relates to these coastal fishing communities and marine habitats, and that is that disaster takes place in context. In this case, some attempts at returning fishing villages to the previous state are making them better able to catch fish, which is potentially detrimental to the future of these fishing communities. The massive scale of overfishing and other threats in the region need to be considered in any development plan and in the planning process for the next disaster. A disaster is always tragic, but it also provides an opportunity to bring blessings. In the case of disasters affecting the tropical coastal communities of the Indian Ocean, you can see from this graph here of the different religions of the world, that this brings an opportunity not only to bring blessing to our Christian brothers and sisters throughout the world, but also to others outside of our faith. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
I'll ask one question. I haven't been involved in this. What degree do you feel that the recovery of the artisanal fisheries, you know, along in Thailand and in Indonesia has progressed at present time? Now, this is a few years after. I know you have the overfishing because you have the better equipment and all that sort of stuff, but in retrospect, do you think it's coming back, and in what degree? Many of the villages, much of the landings, they're smaller, but they're still progressing quite well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would probably vary greatly from place to place.
Place to place, of course.
Yeah, exactly. But I think a lot of the governments now have become aware of these systems, of these problems, And so they're trying to integrate these kinds of principles into the management of the fisheries.
And you established several marine reserves in different sides, both sides of the peninsula?
Yes. Yes, they're trying to establish systems of marine reserves in this area as well. And so there'll be a long process of monitoring what's going on.
Has there been any effort by the United Nations to regulate some of these trawlers that drag across the bottom of the ocean? Or is that just completely national interest and just free game?
Yes, definitely. There's a law of the sea with all sorts of restrictions in certain areas and things like that. There are major changes. For example, they've eliminated the drift nets and so forth, and they focused on harvesting immature stocks of fishes and things like that, new ways of fishing. But it's true what he says, that those trawlers do a tremendous amount of damage.
Right.
And there are now midwater trawls, but they pick them up off the, and that's where our major sources of surimi and things like that are fishes that are in the system. So,
something that's happening.
Everybody's interested in it. The United Nations are interested. Every country's interested in it.
And interestingly, there's been, I think it was in the, right here off the United Kingdom as well, there's been these amazing discoveries of deep water corals, as you saw some of the pictures of. And now that these pictures have come out, I think it's provided a lot of impetus for people to stop some of the trawling. And so there's a lot of effort that's gone on to that as well.
I think we have time for maybe one more question. Some other questions?
Are there marine reserves on the coast of the U.S.? I'm just thinking of the Pacific Northwest, there's all kinds of debate about salmon.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if anything like that exists and what have we observed?
Yeah, there's actually a huge marine reserve program in the U.S. Protecting the Florida Keys. Our research lab was involved in the setting up of the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary and some of the science behind that. There's the largest marine reserve in the world, I think now. It's got a really long Hawaiian name. But there's a remote Hawaiian island, this massive area that's been protected now. And all along the west coast of the U.S., actually, there's quite a few marine reserves. So it's